Podcast. Thanks so much for tuning in again. This week I've got Lilia Christine on the show. You'll hear an introduction from her, but it's very, very fascinating. She's a huge believer in this idea of emotions relating to physical ailments or skin problems or whatever the case may be. But she's also an athlete. She's been a competitive athlete in different competitions. And we get into that. We get into disordered eating. We get into a lot of the things that kind of fall under this whole realm of fitness and wellness and belief and mindset. Kind of everything that encapsulates that world. So I think that you'll love this episode. Here we go. What city in Oklahoma are you at? Are you in OKC proper?
I'm in Oklahoma City.
So, I mean, are you like a basketball fan at all?
Well, I cannot with any ounce of my body root for the Thunder because those are my Sonics. Right. Like I see people walking around with these shirts that say "In Russ We Trust" and I'm like, oh, they must be Seahawk fans. Awesome.
Yeah.
And then someone was like, no, dude, Russell Westbrook. And I was like, oh, F that team.
It's crazy because whenever the Thunder like play on like a major national, you know, national stage, whether it be like a big TNT game or an ESPN game, or they're in the playoffs and they'll say, oh, this is the first time since 1991 that the Thunder have done. And I'm like, no, fuck off.
No,
that's not how it works.
So I still haven't been to a Thunder game. To be honest, there is not that much to do in Oklahoma City. So I probably will go. And I'm trying to like warm up to the idea of rooting for them, but I still have a lot of pain and trauma from my childhood of them robbing the Seahawks. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I always told people if they had kept the name, which I understand doesn't always make sense, if they had kept the name, and like the branding and the image of like the Sonics, they're just now Oklahoma City Sonics, I'd probably still root for them.
Interesting.
But it just felt so. Like, not only do they rob your man, they like change his name. Like, you know, I just, and as a kid, like, you know, they're Seahawks. I couldn't go to Seahawks games. That was super expensive for my family. We mostly went to Mariners games, but the few Sonics games that I went to were just so fun and like such happy memories of my childhood.
Yeah.
Man, it just hurts.
Yeah.
It really hurts.
Yeah. I hear you. No, I know it's tough. It's like, it's weird because I grew up in Northern California. So I grew up like a baseball Giants fan. And I still am a big Giants fan. And of course, in San Francisco is also the 49ers. And for whatever reason, I just can't bring myself to root for them. I don't know. Sports are weird like that.
It's a weird allegiance. But I can say, so I've lived in Oklahoma City for 6 months now. And from what I've seen, the growth of the city and like the cultural revolution, if you will, of like arts and music and things that are food.
Yeah, yeah.
The shifts that are happening are thanks to the Thunder because there would be no scene here without it. So, I mean, I'm thankful because I'm not a small town person. I'm not someone who would choose to live in Oklahoma City. I'm here because of my significant other's career. But it's like, thanks to the Thunder, there's like actually stuff happening around here. There are neighborhoods that are becoming, you know, more revitalized and stuff like that. So I'm happy that they're here. So there's actually at least a scene in the city. Like they're putting a trolley downtown and,
the lawmakers in Seattle, like part of the, like Nick Licata and a lot of these guys, when the Sonics were headed out, or at least the debate was about them heading out, one of the statements that I just can't stop hearing because I was at KJR at the time is that one of them said that like basketball doesn't hold cultural significance to a city. And what you're talking about is cultural significance. And if you go down to Queen Anne now and you see how much of a shithole it is compared to what it was when like in the late 90s, like Sonics are booming, they're going to the playoffs every year versus now, like it's such a shithole, the whole thing.
Dude, Oklahoma City's culture is to thank, or I mean, the Thunder has like shifted the culture, and people that live here will tell you that, and especially people that work in like bar, restaurant industries, hotels, like that's their livelihood.
Yeah.
Without it, you know, they wouldn't be working. So I think it's in a way probably saved the city.
Yep.
At least, especially with tourism and stuff like that, because people are coming from all around the state.
Yeah.
You know, there isn't that much to do around here, especially come fall, winter.
Totally. So I'm here with Lilia Christine. Do you want me to Lilia Christine, or do you want me to use your actual last name?
I go by Lilia Christine.
Okay. we'll go by that. So I'm here with Lilia. So Lilia, I guess give me some some background. I know what you're doing now, but you know, the kind of the nucleus of this podcast has a lot to do with fitness and health and wellness. And it also gets into like the emotional and spiritual side of a lot of this stuff. I had did a video last week where I talked about, you ever seen the movie Point Break, like Patrick Swayze, Keanu Reeves, that movie?
I can't remember it off the top of my head. I know I've seen it. I know the name.
So it's from the early 90s it's about bank robberies, but it's also about surfing. And Patrick Swayze talks about this incredible spiritual connection to surfing that he has. And it goes beyond, you know, people that are watching it that aren't surfers, that don't have a spiritual side to them, probably look at it and go, this guy's fucking nuts. But I think that probably you can speak very well, and I'm sure we'll get into it, but you could speak very well to the spiritual side of an interest or the spiritual side of a hobby and really how it affects you at your core. So where I want to start though is like, so you did fitness competitions, and I met you in college, but you weren't into that stuff at the time. And then a couple of years later, I started seeing you in, you know, bikini contests on Facebook, and you know, you were like super jacked and you're lifting all these weights and stuff like that. And it was like, I just had no idea. I mean, you sat on the other side of the class, and that was kind of what that class was about. Maybe you were into that stuff then, but I guess give me some background on what got you into doing, you know, fitness as, you know, you didn't get into it to be a professional athlete, it sounds like, but ultimately, like, it was something that was a huge part of your life for several years.
Oh, absolutely. So I kid you not, I never played a sport in my life. I have never been on a team sport. I've never done even remotely any kind of sport activity from being a little kid all through high school, through college. I never played sports. Now, I'm a very competitive person, especially like academically and with, you know, what I want for my life. But my family they're huge hippies. My mom just, you know, it wasn't really something that they pushed. It wasn't ever something that was talked about. Had I wanted to, had I had that inclination myself, they probably would have put me into something. But that's really important for the background, because it really sets up for a lot of why I got into competing in figure and bikini shows. But so I never was a very athletic person. You know, I remember in gym class, actually in high school, I had to take one more PE credit, and the only class that was available was a weightlifting class. And I was one of two girls in that class, and I didn't take it very seriously, but it was really fun. I remember getting on the leg press and doing deadlifts and like just being so impressed with how naturally strong I was.
Yeah.
So I always had this propensity for building strength. People used to always ask me like, oh, do you play soccer? Are you a swimmer? Cause just our family genetics, the way I was built, I've got like a broad back and muscular legs. But no, I mean, I never did anything. And then when I was 20, I had transferred up to Western, where we went to school together. Yep. And, you know, there's a beautiful gym, the Wade King Recreation Center, I think, that I started going to. I'd never gone to a gym before, right? So this is included in my membership. And I started getting Oxygen magazine. So I don't know if you've ever seen this, but it's like ripped women, like badass ripped women, amazing backs and shoulders and ab workouts.
So it's not it's not the typical, like, you go to a grocery store and you see the women in the racks where it says, you know, they're kind of these, they're like the runway models. It doesn't sound like it's that.
Right. No, this is like now what you're seeing, the types of females that are competing in CrossFit games and stuff like this.
Okay,
like muscular women. Yeah. Right. So not like over testosterone-y bodybuilding women. This isn't a bodybuilding magazine, but it's, you know, very heavy fitness, lifting weights focused.
Yep.
I also started dating a guy who was a bodybuilder and really into fitness. So that was a huge, heavy influence on me. He actually didn't like that I competed, which is funny. We could talk about that later, but, he was a really good personal trainer. So I had this combination of, hey, I want to do something physical, and I'm really good at weightlifting. Like, I'm just naturally strong. I've got good form. I have good shape. And then I also, like, after a couple years, started working out at Gold's Gym. And there was a woman that worked out there who I just like adored. Like, her body was amazing. And she just was beautiful and graceful and muscular and everything I wanted to be. And she competed in figure shows. And that was the first that I had heard of it. And she worked with a woman named Tangie Johnson, who's actually now one of my very good friends and has been a long-term client of mine. I've done a lot of work for her and for her team through my business. And so I just got kind of, this is before it was super mainstream. I feel like the bikini fitness figure industry has really grown, especially with like Instagram and all the social media. But this is probably what, 2009, 2010, something like that. And so I joined this team of competitors, and a big reason why I wanted to learn to compete was actually because, so one, I wanted to do something competitive with my body. I had never done anything sport related. Two, I thoroughly enjoyed weightlifting, and that's a big part, obviously, of building muscle and having that shape. And then three, I wanted to have a better relationship with food, which is very interesting because the whole process, we could talk about this some more, really screwed up my, I ended up having some pretty bad body dysmorphia and a very, very unhealthy relationship with food, like borderline eating disorder, you know, binge eating, over exercising. So it's very interesting because one of the reasons I got into it was to try to heal that. And it actually just exasperated the issues. And it was, you know, a little bit at first, but I thought it was going to teach me discipline. I felt like I never had discipline when it came to food. So throughout my years of doing shows, I think I only actually did three shows total. I would prep for shows all the time, but I could never get a handle on the food portion. So I was very, very naturally, like, I had the right shape, I could build the right muscle, and I just never could get lean enough. That's what I would hear over and over and over again. And that's what I would beat myself up for. You know, I have
So like a coach would say that?
The judges.
Right? Okay.
So when you do shows, it's very subjective. So I want people to imagine this is like a, not quite a bodybuilding show, because bodybuilding show, especially for men, they're really judged on their physiques, period. Right. So a figure show, which is what I did, it's like a bikini model with a little more muscle, at least at the amateur level. It's very like, you need to be the total package. You have to know how to present yourself. You're spending thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars on your bikini, your heels, your makeup, your tan. Like, this is a huge investment. It's probably one of the most expensive hobbies that I could have had.
Yep.
And on top of it all, even if you are in the best perfect shape that you can be in, you may get ninth place because the judges don't like the way that you pose, or, you know, this judge prefers a more round glute and this one prefers a more striated glute or whatever.
Yep.
And for me, and also with figure girls, a big part of it is abs. Like, I just don't, I'm pretty estrogeny. I'm very feminine looking. So it's like, I've got softness, even though I have a lot of muscle, I have that soft shape. And it's like, no matter what I would do, I just couldn't get my stomach the way that all these other competitors looked. So, I mean, it was very small. Now looking back on it, like, I was in beautiful shape, but to me, I was always just so, I was under conditioned. I wasn't lean enough. So going through years and years of trying to do shows, deciding to not do them, doing shows, you know, it was a process that just really beat me down into, like, your body's not right. Your body is not, and it was because I felt I was not doing a good enough job with my food, and I couldn't figure out why I had so many issues with food. And looking back on it now, the whole process, I mean, I wouldn't change it for anything because it's brought me to where I am now. That was really the foundation of what I'm doing and how I'm helping people now. But it brought to light the fact that I did have a severely dysfunctional relationship with food, and it was something that needed to be healed at an emotional, a mental, and a spiritual level. And it was much bigger than just discipline. Because I would see these competitors who could, you know, eat the same thing every day out of Tupperware, six meals a day. And it's like, I physically couldn't. I would have to, like, force myself to eat food and, like, close my eyes so I wouldn't gag on the turkey that I was eating. Like, it was not enjoyable in any way, shape, or form. The part I enjoyed was the weightlifting.
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah.
And I am competitive, so I did like the competitive portion, but I was never actually competitive on that stage because I just couldn't get that diet piece together. So
how does it, I guess, like, how does it work in terms, so if you're going to go do a, like a weightlifting meet, for instance, usually you're going to operate on like a 12 to maybe like a 16 week cycle. And there's, you know, there's peaking. You want to be in, essentially you want to be in like competition shape at certain intervals during this program. And so like, does it work the same way, or it's incredible, it's just a complete like linear progression where you look a certain way at week one, and then by whatever the, you know, whatever the competition day is, you're at your peak. Like, is there, you know, are there certain things or milestones that you should be hitting, things that are measurable? Because like the human body, there's so many variables. You know, you mentioned like your stomach didn't look the way that it should look, or it didn't look like some of the other girls. You know, those things though are like, they're so subjective, right? Like you could mm-hmm. look at it and say it's bad. I could look at it and say it's great. It's there's too many variables. So are there milestones within the process that you're trying to hit, or that you're you know, that you really want to make happen or check off the list on the way to the actual competition?
Yeah, I would say that it really depends on what level you're competing in and then what division you're competing in. So I can only speak from being an amateur figure competitor, but from what I saw, a healthy prep in theory, because I absolutely am not knocking on the industry, but there's a lot of unhealthiness in that world. Most of it, I would say, has a lot of, you know, 80% of the quote unquote coaches out there and the competitors are like really, you know, not doing very healthy things to their body. Anyway, a healthy prep, I would say most people start like 12 to 16 weeks out is when they like start their prep. But a true competitor never has an off season, right? That's what they tell you.
Right.
So you always, in theory, want to be like, you know, 10 to 15 pounds, if not less, away from your stage weight. Now, I was never that close to things. Like that conditioning, ideally, you have all year round, but you're going to have these cycles where you are going to need to have more fat so you can build up that muscle and have that power, and then slowly taper down. As far as like peaking, they literally call it peak week, the week before your show.
Yeah.
So that week before your show is like where you are dialing in your carbs and you're manipulating things and you're learning. Like a lot of times what, you know, people do contest prep over and over and over again, and they'll even say like, I looked better the weekend before my show or the weekend after my show.
Right.
So it's like, every prep is going to be different, but definitely that week before, you usually can tell if someone's going to do really well or not. But sometimes they lose it, especially as bodybuilders. Like if they're overdoing things or underdoing things, they come in looking flat. And then like 2 days later, they eat a bunch of hamburgers and pizzas, and they get the calories their muscles needed, and they look amazing. Yeah. So honestly, yeah, there are some guidelines, and you can usually tell if someone's going to be competitive. But when it gets down to the really competitive level, it's like you said, it's like micro changes. It has to do with your body chemistry. And then in the female division, it also has to do with your posing, the way your tan looks, the way your hair, your makeup looks, the way, you know, if the judges know you, if you're dating someone in the industry, if you're sponsored by the same people who sponsored the show. So there's a whole lot more to do with it than just the way you look. So there is no perfect prep. And then on top of that, it's a very subjective sport. So as you can probably hear, these are a lot of the reasons why I chose to step away from that world.
I would have never even thought of a political side to it. It never would have entered my mind.
Oh, I mean, TNG Johnson won second place at the Olympia for however many years. You tell me that's not because of the sponsors that she's working with.
It makes me wonder. I mean, I've never watched the Olympia, but usually I'll know who the winner is within, for the men, I'll know who the winner is within an hour of it happening, or 30 minutes of it happening. And I, you know, like Phil Heath has won it like a gazillion times. And either he's tied with Schwarzenegger now, or he's very, very close, or something like that. But I know that I've read like year after year. So I've read a lot about Kai Greene, and I think he's awesome. And but like this past year, so just a couple of months ago, like I saw a lot of stuff online about Phil Heath's belly looking so much bigger than it should for a winner. And so then it started making me wonder, like, could there be something deeper there? And I think a lot of times, like, people want to run to this notion of paying off judges, or there's something dirty happening that way. But what you're saying is like, it might have something to do with who he knows, or it may have something to do with this whole political game that the typical viewer probably doesn't, or the casual viewer probably doesn't know anything about.
Well, and especially the bigger the sport gets, there's a specific look that they're looking for, and that changes. They want someone who's marketable. They want a winner that will make them money, right? So there's that whole side to it of, you know, is, and I'm talking about, to be clear, the NPC and the IFBB. There are other divisions that do shows like the WBFF. I actually did a WBFF show, and I'm sure I wasn't around it for too long, but I at least like in that show, they judge you on marketability. Yep. So you're basically like being looked at as a fitness model product, which is what you kind of are in the other shows, once, especially once you're getting to the professional level, which by no means was what I was doing. And I'm speaking mostly anecdotally and being around the industry for so long.
Yeah.
But at least there's some more transparency when you're in the fitness model category. And one of the categories is your marketability. But here's the thing, that's super subjective. So this goes back to, it's not just politics. Like, one judge might really like brunettes, and they like brunettes with olive skin and dark eyes, and they think that's the look that people want right now. Right. So like the bleach blonde girl with blue eyes or whatever is not going to draw their attention as much as the woman with a really long, gorgeous, you know, brunette hair.
And, yeah, yeah.
And the other side to it is like, there's always what's in trend wise as far as the physique that they're looking for. So when it comes to bodybuilding, I don't think it's a lot, or I don't think it's a secret that there is politics involved. Like with Phil Heath or with Kai Greene not winning, I don't think that's a secret. I think that that kind of stuff, it's like kind of just people know that.
He's definitely like a little against the grain kind of guy. And I wonder, you know, is that a part of it, or I don't want to call him, abrasive is not the right word, because he seems like he's a teddy bear, but for whatever reason, yeah, like you keep almost getting to the top, and I'm, you know, I'm somebody that's on the outside, but I'm looking at it and saying, I think this dude just looks better to me than the other guys on the stage. But for whatever reason, he doesn't seem to ever get past that hump. And then there was something about him getting suspended, or there was something a couple of years ago that was all into that. Okay, so there's things that are out there, people that are not involved in this type of a life that, but they've heard about. So like one of the things I've heard about people that do shows like this is like, they're so depleted by competition day physically that like, it hurts to walk. Like literally like your feet are sensitive. Is that a part of your world? And we're going to get deeper into the, cause I really want to dive a lot into disordered eating, that kind of stuff. I think that stuff is fascinating, but talk to me about like show day. How do you feel?
Oh, you're probably at your most unhealthy you've ever been.
Yeah.
Is what I would say. That's why I say it's like, it's this fitness sport disguised, or this very, very unhealthy thing to put your body through, mm-hmm. disguised as health and fitness. And it's really sad, especially from a female perspective, because we're already inundated with, you know, false narratives about what our body should or shouldn't look like. People see these women on Instagram who it's like the day of their show, and they look at them as this optimal picture of health, and that's their goal. And it's like, you know, that girl that day that she competed was probably at her most unhealthy.
Yeah.
Right. But it's also, it's an extreme sport, right? So you can look at it. I mean, people can have judgments all they want, but if someone goes into this sport knowing this is aggressive on my body, this could mess up my metabolism, but damn it, I want to see what I'm capable of, right? Just like an extreme triathlon athlete or something like that. Like at the end of a triathlon, like a lot of times they're collapsing, or a marathon, they're collapsing, right? So it's like, in a way, you are running yourself ragged, and there may be some really unhealthy aspects to it. But it's, for me, it's kind of like, if you know what you're signing up for and you're prepared for the long-term consequences of that, like I have no judgment over someone choosing to compete. But especially now that it's become so mainstream, I just want to, or I would love for people to really look at what they're getting themselves into and being really sure on the why. You know, like I said, I'm friends with Tangie Johnson. She is a team of women and men that she coaches. She is probably one of the most respected names in the industry. And because I worked side by side with her and was on her team for so long, I saw the right way to do things, right? So can you do it healthy? Yes. But it's still an extreme sport. So you are going to be probably at your weakest, your most depleted, literally, like right before you compete. And then that's why after people compete, everybody is getting like the most caloric foods they can into their bodies because they're just so malnourished, right? Like to get down to that body fat percentage, I mean, you're literally eating like nothing.
There was a picture that you posted. It was the, I think it must have been the morning of a show a few years ago where you had, I'm sure you're going to remember this picture, but you had like a bunch of like, I mean, you know, tons of junk food. They were laying on the bed and you're looking at them like a tiger that's about to go and kill a hyena, right? And I've seen like very similar photos to that, like people that, and it's weird now that I'm thinking back on it, like when you're talking about people see this as this ideal body image. I mean, I probably know a dozen people, mostly female, that have gone and done something like this one time, no more than three times, but then they never touch it again. And when you compare that to something like a, you know, like a CrossFit or a marathon runner or an Ironman or somebody that does triathlons or somebody that swims competitively, like a lot of these different types of sports, snowboarding, anything like that, is that I see them do it every year, year in, year out. And, you know, they look like they're happy with it. But for whatever reason, the staying power in this world seems like it's not really there. And would you attribute that to it being so extreme, or would you attribute that to similar to like in your case where it was like, I thought getting into this, I would have a better relationship with food. It ended up being exactly the opposite. So what am I really in this for anymore? I mean, what do you think that the me seeing people only do it one or two or three times and then mm-hmm. they never touch it again? What's the reasoning for that?
I think it's quite a few aspects. From my perspective, it's not sustainable, right? So it's like, you can only do a, you know, maybe one short show a quarter in a quote unquote healthy manner. So it's not sustainable to your body. You're really messing with your metabolism, your adrenals. Like a lot of people go into adrenal fatigue after doing long-term competing or even a couple shows. Most people are doing some kind of crash dieting. You know, I've heard coaches all the time, people were doing two hours of cardio a day, 6-7 days a week, right?
It sounds so boring, right?
So that's one thing, right? Well, yeah, definitely.
meaning the cardio piece.
I was so bored. So it's not sustainable. It's very, very hard on your body. It's not a consistent sport. So there are benchmarks, but not really. So if it's something like, say you're an amateur snowboard competitor, you know when the meets are, you go to the meets, you know what, you know, tricks you got to work on. And so it's like very black and white almost. And yeah, there may be some style points or whatever, but it's like there's a tangible outcome that's measurable. It's just so subjective. Like you could compete one weekend at a show and look exactly the same the next weekend and get a totally different place because it's different judges and different competitors. So right. I think it's so inconsistent that there is this lack of sustainability with it in that way. And then also, especially as women, and a lot, I've actually worked and coached with a lot of people who used to compete and who've transitioned out of that lifestyle. It's why did you start in the first place? So like we talked about, I thought it was going to be a way for me to be disciplined with food and have a better relationship with my body. And it actually was very much the opposite. You know, there are a lot of people that go into it for similar reasons. Or there are people, and also I loved weightlifting, right? So I went into it because I thought it was a way to like showcase my passion for building muscle and being an advocate for women's body types, however they wanted them to be, which actually I did accomplish, right? So I started, you know, a Facebook page, I don't know how many years ago, 6-7 years ago. And I would post about my training, but I would also post about the mental, the emotional side. You know, I did my best to be an advocate. And I think really I had a boyfriend at the time who was not supportive of me competing.
Right.
I think 'cause he probably could see how much it was actually damaging me now looking back on it. And I was very unhappy doing it. But I remember getting messages from women talking about like how much I've inspired them to like take care of themselves and to be easy on themselves. And especially once I started like getting out of competing. And I remember showing him those messages and being like, see, this is why I'm doing it. So if I look back on it, After a while being a part of that world, for me, it really was being that champion for others. And really the mental, emotional, spiritual side of like being connected with your body was what kept me around the fitness industry.
Yeah.
And so I'm thankful for the experience, but sorry, going back to your question, why don't people keep doing it? I think the reason that they did it to begin with, they accomplished, you know, maybe I just want to see if I can do it. And then they don't go back because it's not sustainable right. for their body, their mind, their emotions, or their soul, right. really is my perspective. Unless you want to be like a very high level professional competitor. And another reason, it's very, very, very expensive. Like most people are spending probably at least $10,000 to do a prep.
Oh, Jesus. Is that the cost of the coaching or what? I guess where's the cost coming in?
I've made a spreadsheet before to show this to people because I always ask them, are you prepared for the cost of competing? Not just the mental, emotional, physical cost, but the actual financial cost. So from a female perspective, so you're obviously spending a lot more on food, especially if you're buying a lot more protein. No matter what, because you're just eating more.
Right.
You've got your gym memberships. You have to learn how to pose. So you're going to be working with a team or with a coach. You probably are hiring a nutritionist. A lot of competitors have at least two or three gym memberships because of how much they need to be working out. So they have one by their job, one where they meet their coach, and one by their house or whatever. Then as a female, you have the cost of the suits. So at the cheap end, you're talking $300-$400. Most suits are going to be over $1,000 if you want them all jeweled out. You have to get your hair done, which is going to be a couple $100. You got to get your whole body waxed because if you shave, you're going to have weird spots. So that's a couple $100. Manicure, pedicure, the shoes, the jewelry, paying. Usually most women have to pay to get their makeup done because they don't know how to do stage makeup. So that's another however many $100. This cost of the spray tan that they put on them, like that's, you know, $100, whatever. All the supplements that people are taking. So there are a lot of natural competitors who aren't doing any kind of drugs. Like I didn't do any kind of body altering drugs, but you know, I'm taking glutamine, glucosamine, pre-workout, protein powders, you know, multivitamins, MSM, like I can't even remember all the ones, the aminos during my intra-workout aminos and, you know, post-workout, whatever, dextrose in my, you know, there's like all these supplements you're taking.
Right.
And it adds up. So I think I track the, and I was cheap about things. Like, you know, I was a broke college student at the time. Or maybe like my first year working and, you know, people get into a lot of debt competing. A lot of women also, even at an amateur level, they feel like they need to get breast implants to be able to advance.
Wow.
Because you get so lean that you have no breast tissue really. Like right. you don't have, it's all fat. So, and coach or judges will even say like, well, you just don't have a very balanced shape in, you know, your chest area. They mean you don't have implants.
Right.
Aesthetic. It looks better when you have implants. So, I mean, I've seen a lot of women that, and it's a personal choice. I'm definitely not judging it, but to be competitive, so that's, you know, some of the extremes that people will go to. So it's very, very, very expensive. And it's very evident people who compete and don't invest, even if they have a great physique, like they just don't look good on stage because they're not wearing the kind of suit that is going to be competitive. Their hair and their makeup doesn't look super competitive. So that's also a side of it.
It sounds to me like it would be cheaper being a man doing this.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Don't get me started on the BS that is the inequality here. And also, I mean, there is definitely the subjectivity and the politics involved in the male bodybuilding world, but it's just a little bit more concise. Now there's also now called male physique, which is kind of the male version of bodybuilding. Like they wear the board shorts and they got the abs and they need to have like the pretty smile and the charisma. So, you know, that division, maybe it is a little bit more about the person, but, I would say that the female side of things is much more subjective and burdensome financially.
Yeah. So you talk about the, you know, the cost of doing a lot of this stuff. One of the things that I want to pull out of that is the supplement stuff. So I did a video last week for people that follow me on Facebook and Instagram and such about the, like the necessity or lack thereof for supplements. If you were to say like now looking back, I mean, obviously if you're competing, it's a little bit different. If you're professional, it's really different. But for general health, say that you want to go to the gym, you want to look fit, you want to look good. Like, you know, what are maybe two things that people should be taking? You know, we're talking not necessarily just general United States population, because, you know, we know what obesity rates and such are like in this country. But for the person that wants to go to the gym an hour a day, 4 or 5 times a week, like, what are, you know, in your mind, you know, a ton of these different things. Like, what are maybe the two that will give you the most bang for your buck?
Okay. So for me, definitely, especially with weightlifting, if I drank amino acids during my work, so BCAA, branched chain amino acids, during my workout, I had way better recovery. I felt better. I don't know if it was psychosomatic, but I would definitely say having branched chain amino acids during your workout would be number one. And those are going to be great for people no matter what. BCAAs, you know, the amino acids are the building blocks of the body, right? They're the building block of muscle building. I don't know, Eddie, I'm not a personal trainer.
Yep.
I just know I felt better when I would consistently be taking aminos versus when I didn't. And you also need to know the quality of what you're taking. Obviously that's a whole other aspect to it. So you want to make sure you're having really good quality. And also honestly for me, I think it really depends on what your goals are. I do like taking a pre-workout when I want to have some really explosive workouts. And there are some cleaner pre-workouts, you know, they're full of a lot of like artificial sweeteners and fillers and stuff like that. But I definitely notice a difference when I take it versus when I don't. Now, that's not a necessity for people. That's a personal preference. I don't take it all the time. I usually take like half of a dose of what they recommend.
Yep.
But that's something that really does help me with now why I work out. And I get a lot of benefit out of that. Outside of that, having a really clean, good protein powder absolutely can be a great supplement to how you're eating, especially if you're trying to build more protein. Whether you're vegan or you're good with dairy or you want to have, you know, there are so many choices with protein now. I think it is a nice supplement to your regular diet. And can be very helpful. So those are the three, I guess, that even to this day, I still find myself going back towards.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I think in the video, I might have said magnesium and protein powder, but.
I will plus one magnesium. So there's one called Calm. It's just like a super simple magnesium drink. Mm-hmm. So that's definitely, I mean, magnesium can help us in so many ways, but even just the simple fact of like getting yourself to sleep or if you have severe anxiety. And then also, interestingly enough, I have a friend who used to have a lot of dairy sensitivity, but once she started taking magnesium, she was fine with dairy. So I don't even know how those are correlated. This is what she's told me. She's like, yeah, once I started taking magnesium, I was fine with dairy.
You know, so what I may attribute some of that to, I'm glad you said the sleep thing, is that when I work with clients, like one of the things that I have so much beef with traditional personal trainers and kind of the way that when I say fitness industry, I'm talking about, you know, Joe Smith that has a membership to like a 24-hour fitness and walks in and talks to the personal trainer, I want to get in shape. And then you kind of see how, generally speaking, like it's just not that great of an experience, I feel like, looking from the outside. But I've never once heard a personal trainer ask somebody about what their sleep is like. And if you think about like the ability of the natural body to recover itself, whatever it is that can get you, like when I was at my worst in terms of, you know, chronic pain issues or psychosomatic issues, it's like I'd go to sleep tense and I'd wake up every hour, every 90 minutes. And then as soon as I'd wake up to start my day in the morning, like boom, immediately, like my body is like rock solid, rock hard again, like fight or flight immediately, because it just never had a chance to get into that recovery. And I was talking to a naturopathic doctor recently about my longstanding dairy issues, which I haven't been, you know, I used to have ice cream all the time, 7 days a week, and I had milk 7 days a week, and I never had a problem. And then suddenly, I mean, it was literally like you flipped a switch in 2013, like towards the end of it, and my body just couldn't handle it for whatever reason anymore. And she had attributed this more so to a stomach bug and had talked about sleep and things like that. Gave me some recommendations, but she said she felt like within a few months I could have dairy again and not have a problem, which, you know, I haven't had cheese in 4 years. And for the women in my life, They love cheese. And so to be able to have that kind of stuff again would be pretty cool. So it's interesting you say the magnesium piece. I wonder if it's like person is sleeping better, therefore whatever perhaps bug they might have in their system then gets a little bit more cleaned out, gets a little bit fixed, and then, you know, kind of the tripe or whatever that's on the inside of their stomach is going to really help itself, because leaky gut's like a real thing too.
Oh yeah. I'll give a shout out to one of my clients, Michelle Casey. She's a holistic nutritional therapist. She is the kind of person that could all day talk to you about the science behind how all of these pieces correlate. So definitely if anybody's experiencing anything like that, intestinal, the digestive stuff, like work with someone like you were working with a naturopath or someone who can look at the holistic aspect of things. Now, when people hear the word holistic, sometimes they, you know, have a little trigger. They think it's like BS, but literally holistic means looking at the whole of things, right? Yep. So looking at how you're sleeping, looking at how stressed you are, looking at your emotional response to foods, right? Like this is what we're talking about with holistic, looking at the actual food that you're eating, as well as like the supplements or your mineral levels. And that's why I love people like my friend Michelle Casey, because she helps her clients. She looks at the whole picture. And it's so often missed in Western society. And we want the quick fix and we want things to just, you know, take a pill and go away. And it's like, no, it's not just physical. It's not just behavioral. It's emotional. It's mental. And I believe energetic or spiritual is a whole other component to it that so many of us are neglecting.
Well, and people rolling their eyes like it's bullshit. I know exactly what you're saying, because like Tia Wright and I talked about that when I asked her, you know, what do people say when you talk about there's emotional component to physical health? And she says they roll their eyes and they think I'm crazy, but that's just the way it is. And she's been in the competitive, you know, competitive realm of athletics long enough to know that that certainly is the case. But I think it's absolutely all the case. And again, like just to prove that in the world people have, especially like in Western society, that it's almost like if I tell you that my back hurts, it's more acceptable than to tell you that I'm just overwhelmed with life right now, because everybody's kind of expected to be, you know, we're strong and we work 40 plus hour work weeks and we, you know, we do all of this kind of stuff. But like, you know, people have and everybody's different, which again goes into the like the human variable and the emotional variable and all of that. But I remember going to a sports chiropractor in 2013, and I couldn't, when I was in Little League, I slid into third base and I hurt my knee, and I remember I went in and they told me I had something, but they're like, you know, you're probably going to need some kind of surgery on your knee and, you know, this kind of stuff. And you probably won't be able to squat. And I'm like, look, like I just slid into third base wrong. I mean, how can I be broken forever? I'm 13 years old or whatever. And, but I could not squat to parallel without pain. It just felt like I had a really, really tight rubber band, like almost like under my patella, and couldn't figure it out. So I just didn't squat. And in weightlifting and CrossFit, like squatting is such a big component of it. And then there was a chiropractor that came and did like a seminar at our gym, and he was doing free seminars at the time. And now he charges, I don't know, $200, $300, $400, $500 per person to go to these. So I got to go in the free era, which was great. But he recommended loosening up a muscle that was in my glute. And I did that, and suddenly my knee bended without pain. And that was 4.5 years ago. And it's like that is acceptable because it's in the physical realm, even though he's looking holistically, right? Like if I go to a doctor because my shoulder's bugging me tomorrow, he's just going to look shoulder, 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 when really like that shoulder problem might be from somewhere else. And that somewhere else might be in the mind, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, in the work that I do, I'm very, very on the energetic, spiritual side of things. So to me, there's always a connection. But you talk about shoulder pain, like at a physical level, oftentimes comes from actually a hip imbalance, right? Yep. So, and I believe energetically, our hips are where we store a lot of trauma. So especially as women, we carry a lot of trauma in our hip area, and a lot of the pain that a lot of us experience stem from hip issues, right? Lower back pain, even knee pain, shoulder pain, neck pain. A lot of it is directly related to the hips, actually, if you, at a physical level. And then outside of that, looking at what traumas have you experienced in your life that you haven't allowed yourself to release? What are you still storing in your mind, your heart, your body? There is an energetic component to pain that I believe if we addressed a little bit more and were more open-minded about it, we'd have people feel a lot better. Here's the other thing for me. People can be skeptics all day long, but here's the thing. If you're in pain and there was something that could make you feel better, why wouldn't you want to try it out? Why not give yourself the opportunity to see, hey, maybe there's something to this, and release the stubbornness and actually look at, and this can get even bigger. I believe a lot of people do not feel that they are worthy of feeling good. They are in this story of being in pain for so long, and the physical aspect is oftentimes to them proof of, you know, how hard they worked or what they've gone through, and that they're deserving of this pain, and somehow it's glorified, right?
Yeah.
And they're not feeling good isn't good enough, because that means you're not working hard if you feel good. And so there's this whole emotional component as well, this mental side of like not actually wanting to get better because there's some kind of badge of honor to having this injury and having this long-term pain. And I see that even, and you hear that word like playing the victim. I don't mean it in that way. This is a, you know, this can be a very subtle thing and that we all do in our own ways, but it's like, we are more comfortable with the pain because we know how to manage it. And we would almost rather, there's a book I recommend to everybody called The Untethered Soul. And it's a book really that talks about how we interact with our mind, and it's written very matter of factly. It's pretty awesome. But one of the sections they talk about is, you know, imagine if you had, I'm paraphrasing here, like a big thorn in your arm, a giant thorn in your arm, this pain, this big thorn. And so what you did is you adjusted your entire life around the fact that you have a thorn in your arm. And so maybe you make a little contraption so that when you sleep, you don't roll over and squish yourself on this thorn. Or when you're talking to people, you ensure that they stay back so that it doesn't dig in a little bit deeper. Because for you, it's more scary to address pulling that thorn out and going through the healing process of removing this piece of pain. And you get so attached to, like, you're the guy with a thorn in his arm.
Yep.
That you don't even remember what it could be like to not have that thorn there, on top of the fact that you are too scared to heal, to perhaps cause more pain to heal something. And the, like, because a lot of times when we dig into physical symptoms, there's a mental component that almost hurts more, right? Of, you know, looking at being hard on ourselves, or, you know, choosing lifestyle or behavior pieces that we need to change that are going to be really, really hard to change. There's a lot more pain that can come up that's more than just that physical pain you're experiencing. So we avoid it. We would rather live with the pain that we have than grant ourselves permission to expose what's deeper. And the reason we don't go deeper, because it might hurt. And we have a lot of examples in our life where digging into stuff hurts.
Gosh, I'm so glad that you said the thorn in the arm thing. It's like, it's such a good analogy. I see a therapist every week. This is a mental therapist, not a physical therapist. And then the naturopathic doctor she uses this, I think it's called NET, neuro-emotional technique, is like part of where she does like manual muscle testing. But while she's doing this, she's asking typical trigger questions. Tell me about your, if I made this statement about your wife, if I said this about your kid, and it's really like when your muscles go weak, she knows that maybe that's something that should be exploited. And I saw my therapist on a Wednesday, and then I saw this NET naturopath on Friday, and they both found triggers, the same trigger. And I never brought it up to the naturopath. Like, I never, you know, there was no way for me to lead this in. It wasn't on the intake form. There's nothing like that. But she started digging. About 10 questions in, she got to the same one. And it happened more in the therapist's office. It was right next to weeping. It wasn't quite weeping, but it was close.
Oh, yeah.
And what it ended up being, or what, you know, a big component of this that I'm working through, is like sort of feeling in my head, whether it was true or whether it's not actually the case, like in my mind, I sort of see myself Or I envision my family kind of looking at me like, you have to be sort of the golden boy of the, you know, I have three brothers, and you know, the stories of all of them are unique, but especially the one directly older than me and directly younger than me. It's sort of like, you have to not be the burden, and you have to kind of be the kid that's not going to get in trouble or have issues or any of this kind of stuff. Cause really we need to spend our time and attention focused on these other kids. And like, they never once said that to me. And I almost feel like they never made me feel that way, but the unconscious, you have really no power over what you've, you know, nope. I have as much power over telling my unconscious what is true and what's not true as I do if I walked out to get my mail and somebody hit me by a car. Like I have no way to. So kind of what they've been getting at with this is that I would rather be in pain with my back or my neck or my lats not working or whatever the case is than to grab that thorn of feeling like I need to be perfect all the time and actually pulling it out mm-hmm. of my arm. And it reminds me a lot. There was a great like 2020 story, and I have to remember to send this to you right when we're done. It's like 11 minutes, but it focuses right into what you're talking about with emotional basis of pain. And so John Stossel, who used to work on 2020 with Barbara Walters, and he was kind of like the second in command guy that was there. But there's a story where he's talking about his back pain, 20 years of chronic back pain. He's having a lay on his back all the time, and he's having constant spasms, and he estimated that in that span where he had pain, he spent the equivalent of about 15 years laying on his back, because he felt like he'd go to physical therapy and he'd get heat wraps and massages and all this kind of stuff. And then once he went to go see Dr. John Sarno, and Sarno was asking him about his life and his you know, emotional pain, he was cured after one lecture. And this was in 1999, and he recently talked about it again in 2016, and he still hasn't had any back pain since. And his brother is a doctor at Stanford, and also has chronic neck and back pain. And again, like, being a doctor at a major university can inherently bring stress and anxiety and things that will cause emotional pain. John Stossel says to him, why don't you try this emotional side? And, you know, maybe there's something to it. And the guy says, there's a lot of things out there that are ridiculous that I could try that probably won't work. But then they show him a second later, you know, having one of those stupid traction devices that's hung over a door, and he spends 30 minutes a day in that thing. And if he, like, 30 minutes a day, 7 days a week for 10 years, it's like you're throwing away a lot of it, when really maybe just ripping that thorn out of your arm can.
Well, we're addressing the symptoms as a culture, not the root.
Yep.
We're too afraid to rip that root out, or to even look at that root.
Right.
So we'll do everything to hide behind the symptoms. And I mean, so I do holistic work, and I used to do one-on-one personal coaching, and now it's really transitioning into running group programs and doing as much as I can online to reach as many as people as possible. And this is the biggest theme that I see with everybody I work with and in my own life, is, you know, looking at the root of stuff is really painful sometimes. Yeah. It's really scary. And, you know, and I'm not talking about bad stuff. You know, I'm not judging what it is. Sometimes it's looking at the root of our worthiness, looking at the root of, we already are enough just being the way that we are, and really accepting what we're deserving of. Like, those things are really hard for people, because we have these stories, these frameworks that we built up as children based on what information was presented to us that we subconsciously still believe is true. I wanted to really quickly, because I wanted to share about how I've actually, I wouldn't say cured, but I would say transformed my relationship with food, actually is with subconscious work. So, because you brought up, like, you know, I have this subconscious story that I can't control, and there's no way to change that. Or I forget how you said it. Like, I don't have control over that. Right. Mm-hmm. Now, while we don't have control of this automatic scripts that are happening, I do believe we do have the ability to kind of crack open that and blur the lines a little bit and get into that subconscious. That's one of the biggest reasons why meditation is very powerful for people, because it allows them to quiet their logic brain and really allow impressions to happen to their subconscious. But like any habit, in order to have a new habit, to release an old habit, you have to have a new habit that is contradictory to the old one. So you have to reprogram your subconscious with an affirmation or a new belief that is contradictory to this one that you believed when you were a little kid. So the way that I did this in my own life, and mind you, this is way before I ever would have considered myself spiritual or, you know, a holistic teacher like this. I was not comfortable with any of this kind of stuff. I was so desperate to change my relationship with food that I was looking up every kind of way I could heal it. And I looked up traditional behavioral, cognitive behavioral therapy. You know, I looked up Overeaters Anonymous. Like, I felt like I really needed to change this. And I stumbled upon hypnotherapy. And I was reading the reviews of this lady on Google, and literally review after review after review is like, I'm not the kind of person who does this, but oh my gosh, this changed everything for me. You know, people that couldn't stop smoking to save their life, you know, no matter what they tried, or people who had, you know, obesity and were able to finally get down to a normal weight. And then I started reading behind the science of hypnotherapy. And really what it is influencing the subconscious mind, getting you into a relaxed enough state to reprogram that. And they were saying, like, I don't remember the statistic. It was like 4 to 5 times quicker, 10 times quicker, something like that, than traditional cognitive behavioral therapy for these same issues. And I was like, well, I want the shortcut, right? Yeah. Like, I was like, well, I want to try this out. So I went to a woman, it's called Center of the Universe Hypnotherapy in Fremont in Seattle. And again, this is not something I normally would have done, but I was desperate. I didn't know the root of why I had this eating thing, but I knew it needed to change. So I went there, and the way that it worked, actually, so I did 3 sessions and spread out over the course of like a month or two. They were each, I want to say, like 90 minutes, quite a long time. The beginning, what we did is we talked about where I was at, how I was feeling. It felt kind of like traditional therapy. And then together with the therapist, we wrote out new beliefs around the pieces that I wanted to energetically shift. And then what she would do is get me into a relaxed state, which now looking back on it is no different than basically meditation. People just have this idea of like being hypnotized, and it's really just like going into a meditative state,
swinging the clock back and forth in front right. of you. Yeah.
Yeah. And all that does even is just gets you relaxed enough. And the thing is, you can't do anything you don't want to do. So if you want to be in that calm of a state and access your subconscious, the way she explained it to me is getting in a hypnotic type state is basically that line between your conscious and your subconscious gets a little bit blurred. So you actually have the opportunity to influence some stuff back in there that seems kind of hardwired in. So, and it doesn't happen overnight, and you have to continually practice. Like, there's homework outside of the sessions. But I noticed how much it helped me about a year after I had done it. Right. So it was like a seed that got planted of healing, and actually brought out a lot, I realized, of childhood stuff, of mm-hmm. why I was turning to food, family lineage pieces, you know, addictive behavior, things that kind of ran in my family. And so I was the person who at all times I was thinking about food, what I could eat, what I couldn't eat, what I wanted to eat, how I felt about what I wanted to eat, how I felt about what I had eaten, what I should eat, what I shouldn't eat. I mean, literally all the time, like I all the time was thinking about food. And competing really made that worse for me, because it was even more like, here are the rules you must follow. And yeah. Interestingly, 12, I went
two,
to that
4, 6, 8. Yeah.
Yeah. And I went to that hypnotherapist while competing because I wanted to be able to figure out how to compete better. Right. So it was pretty funny. And what we were able to do was truly influence my subconscious about my relationship with food and kind of give me some new, I forget how she, like, reprogramming isn't the right word, but that's basically what we were doing. Cause I see it as this memory bank. We were like putting in new affirmative messages in my subconscious so that it actually did make sense how I interacted with food and the choices that I made. I was the person, if I bought like ice cream and it was in my freezer, I would know every single, I was a sweets person. So baked goods, candy, you know, anything sugary. And it's because I didn't get any of that as a kid. And we didn't get any of that as a kid because, one, we didn't have a lot of money. And two, my mom had an unhealthy relationship with those foods and she didn't want us to develop it. But it, you know, the kind of the opposite happened. It was like what you restrict is what people really want. And I have a predisposition to want it. So it's like, anyway, so I realized about a year later, I was moving, maybe a little bit more than a year later, or yeah, probably around a year. I was moving and I was packing up my house and my friend was helping me clear out my cupboards. And we were finding like half open bag of cookies and like old candy and like stuff that was expired. And I'm just, and like ice cream that's totally like crystalled over in my freezer.
Right.
And I was like, are you kidding me? There is no way in hell that food would not have been gone within a day or two.
Yeah.
Before I went through what I went through. And mind you, I was doing a lot of other emotional, mental work in my life. But that was really the starting point of recognizing I can address the subconscious beliefs and do a modality that normally would seem weird to me. But hey, it worked. And I always say this with the work I do with all of my clients. I don't really know how things work. I'm not here to prove anything to you. I'm not here to convince you of anything. I'm here to offer you insight and spark within you what feels true for you so that you can go out there and try it. Whether it's psychosomatic, whether it's there's actual proof of it, if it works, why not allow yourself to explore being pain-free, whether that is emotional, mental, physical, energetic, whatever. Why not see? Why not? That was like literally my phrase is why not? That was what helped me transition through one of, you know, the darkest periods of my life when it came to my relationship with myself, my body, and really allowed me to bloom into the person who's now helping to guide others.
Yeah.
Do I always have it figured out? Absolutely not. We're always growing. We're always changing. We're always learning. But I've gained so much perspective in that there's no one right way to do anything. You know, every single human is a unique snowflake. So what works for me may not work for you, but why not be open to what could be possible for you and your experience here in this lifetime?
Sarno would say a lot if you can't, you know, like I'm a big science guy and I, you know, I'm an evolution guy. I'm not a creationism guy. But one of the quotes he always had was, if you can't prove it in a lab, most people don't think it exists. And like, I mean, that's like science has done so much good for the world and you know, modern medicine and things like that. And they help alleviate a lot of problems and treat a lot of problems. But at the same time, again, like the emotional part of it is, it's such a wild card and it's so variable that it's impossible to duplicate in a lab, which really is a shame for a lot of people because they live, like, I remember exploring like spinehealth.com or something like that. And there's, you know, they have hundreds of thousands of members that are on there talking about these, you know, back pain incidents and they've had four surgeries and they're going to go have a couple more. And occasionally I'll see somebody say, have you thought about addressing emotional cause? And it's like, absolutely not. No, I know that I'm completely fine and all that. And you're right. I
think Eddie, it's like, they want to keep the thorn.
Yeah.
They want to keep that thorn. They don't want to pull that thorn out. They don't even want to acknowledge there's a thorn there.
And it's interesting you also saying the part about like people almost not feeling worthy to live without this pain. Like one of the reasons that I just like I started to really admire Tia Wright's story so much is when she, so we like knew each other for years and but we had never had a conversation. I just sort of saw her as this other girl in the gym and that was it. And then I was telling part of her, she hasn't had the big triumph she's waiting for. I think it's coming in the next year. But my therapist had asked me about, you know, think of somebody in your life who sort of is like faced a personal tragedy, which tragedy can be defined in a lot of different ways. For her, in my eyes, it's that she's worked her entire life to make it to the CrossFit Games. And 2 years in a row, 2016 and 2017, she went into the final of 12 or 13 events in a position to get to the CrossFit Games. All she would have to do is finish middle of the pack in the final event. And both years she finished near dead end and lost it in the final minute after she trains all year. It happened 2 years in a row. But she said that she sort of sat there. One of them had like these rope climbs and she crushed that in practice and it wasn't a problem. And then for whatever reason, she just couldn't get her body to respond to competition. And she said she sat there looking up at the rope and saying, I don't deserve this. And so for her, it's like she's in phenomenal physical shape, but the biggest hurdle for her has been this emotional side. And as soon as she said that, mm-hmm. I was like, all right, I'm bought in, because I never bought into the concept before that. But when she says that kind of stuff, I think when like humans miss the, and it's only getting worse, I feel like, but I almost feel like there's sort of a change in the guard with a lot of people. Like, as I've been so open talking about emotional issues, I'm seeing a lot of people sort of also come forward and talk about the same thing that I know. And maybe it's about to shift, but I think like vulnerability is a huge thing that we miss with each other.
Well, vulnerability is like one of the biggest tools to shifting the world, right? Because that allows us to practice empathy when people are vulnerable with us. And I think a lot, I mean, at a social level around the world right now, the number one problem we have is a lack of empathy. First and foremost, a lack of empathy with ourselves, and then a lack of empathy with others. And the only way we can get there is by practicing active vulnerability. Like, how can you be there for someone and feel for them if they're not showing who they really are and what's really happening?
Right.
How can you be there for yourself? How can you learn your worthiness if you cannot be vulnerable with yourself? If you cannot allow yourself to look at that thorn of whatever's happening in your life and be vulnerable and work to remove it and heal where it had been, they go hand in hand. And I think we are shifting, especially as the younger generations kind of come up in age, we're shifting to a more empathic society. And that's something that, you know, I'm at the forefront of advocating for, because if we really did all see each other as worthy of living and existing in equality and had that empathy for others, you know, we really wouldn't have the problems that we have right now. And I'm a bit of an idealist, and I know that there's always going to be issues, but the more empathy, the better. And like you said, with the vulnerability, it totally goes hand in hand. I think that that's why you're starting to see more of it. You're starting to see a lot more transparency, and people showing their imperfections, to inspire others, right? Like, redefining what it is to be experiencing pain. I think the strongest thing you can do is allow yourself to heal, right? Because what we do is we wear it, like I said before, we wear it like a badge of honor, like the no pain, no gain. Like, I worked so hard for this pain. And it's like, I think it's time for us to allow to find pleasure in life and the lightness and the ease and the gentleness. And that is actually one of the most courageous things we can do, and change the narrative of what it means to work hard. You know, I'm learning in my own life how to transition from this very working hard mentality to preparing and receiving, asking, receiving. So it's less action as it is receiving, and preparing myself to be able to receive the opportunities. And there's a gentleness that can unfold in your life, both with your relationship with yourself and then everyone that you interact with, when you take this approach of softening up and receiving what you're worthy of, instead of feeling like you need to fight for it.
Yep.
We don't have to be survivalists anymore, right? I think we are all, as humans, kind of shifting to this next level of awakening. You look throughout history, from, you know, being cavemen to like the Renaissance, and there's all these chapters where we're all kind of waking up to the next level. And I think that's exactly what's happening, is an emotional and an energetic revolution of people wanting to be like more loving people to themselves and to others.
And not just stuck in fight or flight all the time.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. And like you said, you know, your pain was directly related to you being in that fight or flight place.
All the time. All the time.
All the time. Like, you were always in a state of, what's wrong? What's happening? What do I need to fix? What's broken? What did I do? How can I work harder to fix this?
Which is weird, because it's like my therapist calls it like the reptilian response to the brain. Mm-hmm. He actually says it's the root of PTSD is that exact thing, where if you think about, I remember I was working at a grocery store once, and there was a guy who was in Desert Storm, the first Desert Storm, and he was working at the store at self-checkout. Somebody dropped a pallet from 20 feet in the air or something in the back room that was, I mean, it was almost, it was like 75 yards away, and it was in a warehouse. And so it hit the ground, like when it fell and the loud bang happened, he was on the ground before the sound, like the sound yeah. waves got to me. I didn't even hear it. And he was already on the ground. And the Dr. Copeland, the therapist I work with, had said that, you know, that's sort of how you interpret a threat. And the thing about the mind is that, like, I don't know the difference between a tiger that's jumped through my window and is chasing me and a customer not buying a contract from me or saying they will and then they won't.
Right.
Or my daughter spilling a can of LaCroix and the liquid coming close to my computer, they're all threats. And unfortunately, the yep. nervous system can't say that this LaCroix is a lesser threat than the tiger.
So that's why one of the biggest things I advocate is becoming friends with your body, respecting that your body has that response, but sitting back and having a more conscious relationship with it. And this is that active awareness of your life and being the observer of when your body responds. Cause I believe we are, you know, I'm definitely a more spiritual person. I believe that we are souls having a human experience. It's like this human body is the car that we get to hang out in. When you're driving your car down the road and you start hearing a tinging in the car, like a sound happening, you don't immediately look at yourself and go, what's wrong with me?
Right.
Oh my gosh. You're like, oh no, I need to take care of my car. I need to help it. I need it to get fixed so it can keep taking me where I need to go. And if I keep ignoring that sound and driving with it, you know, we might have some issues down the road.
Yep.
But a lot of times, what do people do? They just turn up the radio.
Yep.
They don't want to, you know, they don't want to deal with it because yep. it might be expensive. It might be scary. So I think we can, you know, we can't fight biology, but we can make friends with it. We can open ourselves up to different types of modalities, whether they are spiritual, religious, you know, emotional, behavioral, mental. There are so many tools we have at our disposal to become friends with our body, get to know it in the way that works for us, and really transform our lives, again, holistically, so that our relationships, you know, when we feel better, we're more friendly to be around. We, you know, we're going to see opportunities show up to us. People are going to want to work with us. You know, we may actually be able to climb that rope that we thought we weren't worthy of climbing before. When we start with our relationship with our bodies and we come at it from a very loving, well-rounded perspective without fear of what we may find, I firmly believe it transforms every single aspect of life. And then you become this beacon for others and you become this example of how it really does work. And so that you can inspire other people to do the same. And that's how I think we make the most lasting effect on our 5 foot of influence, right, around us, is taking care of ourselves first and being okay sharing about the challenges of how much that thorn hurts, but actively showing that it is possible to look at the root of things and to heal ourselves. And yeah.
In a really indirect way, do you know who C.T. Fletcher is?
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I think if I were to ask him, hey, you know, give me your take on some of this, like, emotional versus physical stuff, I think he'd say, well, fuck you. You know, like, I sort of say, but if you, I feel like if you also, I've listened to so much of the stuff that he talks about. And if you listen to him talk about, like, when he was a competitive power lifter and things like that, that he absolutely, like, before he said he would walk in to all of the, this is in his movie, My Magnificent Obsession, but he would walk into the back room before like a big powerlifting meet, and he would literally stand up and say, who's coming in second, because nobody's beating me. And he would go on to say to himself, like, I can will my way
yeah.
into winning any of this stuff. And that really, like, his biggest battle is always going to be him, you know, what's between his ears and, you know, who does he see in the mirror?
It's just different vocabulary, Eddie.
Yeah.
Like, honestly, that's one thing I've noticed, is a lot of us are saying the same thing, just in a way that works for us. Athletes have been doing visualizations for I don't even know how long. And they've actually proven how much visualization can help your success, right? They had an experiment where someone imagined, they measured the finger strength or thumb strength or something. They have you visualize pushing your thumb against something. And they, like, measured the strength of this. I'm really annihilating this, I'm sure, amazing research study. But and mind you, I heard about this on NPR, but the actual visualization of it in their mind created more physical strength in their body, period.
Yeah.
Like it was that measurable and it was a well-rounded of enough study that they had, you know, and athletes, what do? They visualize winning. They put on that soundtrack. That's their, you know, they go and they smash their practice, visualizing themselves being in that game. Anyone who's competing at a really high level is already bringing in the mental aspect into things. Well, and so if we can,
there's two things that make me think of that. So we've heard the anecdote forever, like the mother whose kid is trapped under a car, she gets this quote unquote adrenaline rush and can walk over to the car and lift it. But I was driving last week, my daughter was acting insane. And so we had to go and do at six in the morning, a 2-hour drive and let mom sleep a little bit longer. And she's sitting in the back, she's listening to Taylor Swift, and it kind of gives me a chance to sort of like sit back and I started thinking about that theory, like the idea of a parent feeling so threatened because their kids are gonna be crushed by this car that they can lift it up no problem. And I absolutely believe in that. But when rethinking about it, I think it's the visualization is part of it. But then also at that moment you are absolutely forced, again, fight or flight, you've ripped out anything else emotionally or any other the other shit that could be going on in your mind, and all you have is that, like, you're putting everything you have into this one thing, and like athletes become obsessed with winning and they become obsessed with success, and the ones that really can clear out a lot of that other shit are the ones that are hitting 40 home runs every year or the ones that are throwing for 4,000 yards every year. And I talked to a sport, it's the reason that sports psychology as a category even exists. And I think that a lot of other industries like sales, for instance, absolutely need sales psychology. And like if you walk into a sales office and you say sales psychology, they're thinking about the psychology and the interaction
of the buyer,
right? Of the buyer. When I think it really needs to be, how can you take somebody that's been successful a long time and stumbles and sort of unfuck them? Because it exists in athletes, and the sports psychologist I talked to works with the football team at a major university, one of the top universities in the world. And he had told me that, like, you know, if a receiver has a bad game, drops a few passes, things like that, it sounds like it is an enormous amount of work to get him to unfuck himself in the next 5 or 6 days before he has to go and play again. Because that, it makes me wonder, like, God, how bad off could some of these athletes be if they didn't have somebody like that at their disposal? And then you start thinking about, like, there's a huge intersect between poverty levels, economic levels being lower, and people being in chronic pain, and they don't have somebody, you know, they just don't have, they're not well enough off to have somebody at their disposal that can even just sort of listen to their problems. And like, there's been a lot of research on this, and one of the movies that I just watched called All the Rage, and the filmmaker actually had agreed to do an interview with me sometime in the next couple of months. It'll be cool to talk to him, but he goes into depth a lot about this interaction between people of, again, economic levels and chronic pain. And I think that a lot of it just has to do with first of all, they're pissed and they have a lot of rage at the fact that they're sort of in this position in life, but they don't have any way to uncover it. And they don't have the money to help someone or to be helped to try to uncover it. I don't know. The whole thing is incredibly fascinating. And now, like, as I learn more about like a dermatologist link between emotions and skin problems. And
I have firsthand examples of that.
I also know that there's certain conditions, or like thoracic outlet syndrome it's terrible. Cuts off people's nerves and their circulation, and they end up having these neck surgeries that I think it's like 50 or 60% of the time aren't even successful. But one of the things that I really pull out of the statistics in that, and fibromyalgia, exact same thing, is that so thoracic outlet syndrome is 4 times more likely to happen in women than men. And I think fibromyalgia is like 16 times more likely to happen in women than men. And if I were to just ask you, like, gun to your head, who has a tough time dealing with emotional problems or struggles, is it men or women? I feel like you would probably say female, right?
Well, this goes back to in order to evolve as women, you know, back in caveman days, you are relying on group connectedness mm-hmm. and social and emotional intelligence in order to maintain your survival.
Yep.
So it is literally embedded in us to be cueing into the emotional, mental, and social aspect of being human as a survival instinct. So especially to a female, social failure is feels just as horribly scary as a physical failure.
Right.
So it's at a DNA level, you know, and everybody's different, but I would say at a DNA level on a whole, women tend to be deeper immediately from young age with the emotional and mental side, because it's how we're wired. But that also means that we also have sometimes a greater skill set in healing these pieces. That's why you see a lot of women working in healing professions, whether they are, you know, mental, emotional, or physical. The one-on-one, like, what is the stereotype? Most nurses are females, right? Because that is that firsthand healer that you have a connection to, that yep. empathy, that emotional intelligence, or, you know, a lot of family counselors and therapists, a lot of times are women, because they have that natural intelligence to the emotional side of things, even though it can also overwhelm us immensely. I would definitely, I know we got to finish up soon here, but, for any of your listeners who are open to exploring all different kinds of aspects to this, there's an author, she recently passed away, but Louise Hay, she's very well known in my circle. And she has a book called You Can Heal Your Life, like Heal Your Body, Heal Your Life. And basically every single physical ailment, she's connecting back to a thought, mentality, emotional, energetic side of things. So a lot of times, you know, and there are mixed reviews about people that believe this, but, I've seen in my own life how, like, my back went out around a time when I was going through some financial issues and had been betrayed by someone close to me. And it's exactly what she talks about in her book, like not feeling supported by the universe or from people around you. And I'm like, I used to have cystic acne all around my neck, and this is before I started doing my work and sharing my voice and doing public speaking.
Yeah.
Well, guess what? As soon as I started sharing my voice and feeling worthy of sharing my voice, imagine that, the giant pimples around my neck started to heal. So while it may not always be the 100% blanket reason, not looking at the energetic, emotional, mental side of our physical experience, to me, you're robbing yourself of a healing that could happen in a much gentler, more sustainable way.
I just bought it. It's 91 cents on Kindle.
Awesome.
And it has so it's 4.75 out of 5 stars, and it's got 2,298
right.
reviews.
Oh yeah. I have she is probably the leader of that, the energetic side of your relationship with your body and your energy. And she actually doesn't call it illness. It's dis-ease. So we have ease, like we feel ease, yeah. and then we feel dis-ease. That's what disease really is. So the intro to that book, basically, before I even knew what my beliefs were, when I read it, I was like, yep, this is everything I believe.
Yeah.
So it was one of those life-changing books that I got around the time that I was transforming my relationship with myself. So yeah. I wanted to make sure I let your listeners know about one of my favorite resources.
Yeah, yeah, that's great. So we are wrapping up. We're almost at an hour and a half. That's great. anything else that you want to talk about? We've covered like so much stuff. Anything else? I mean, you want to plug your stuff or what it is that you do, or what do you think?
Totally. Yeah. They're like, wait, who is she? Yeah, what is she doing? Trying to solve the puzzle. So I have a business called The Happiness Advocate, really about finding what happiness means to you and advocating for you to love yourself and the life that you create. I used to do one-on-one coaching. I have found that I want to help more people. So I've transitioned to really doing as much as I can online and reaching a wider audience. And so what I've created literally like a week ago, this launched, is a program I am so excited about called Sunlight School. And it is a monthly membership program like a gym, but for your mind, body, and soul, online, where you have access to coaching materials, videos, resources around love, relationships, financial abundance, spirituality, your relationship with your body, running a business with soul, following your dreams, finding your purpose. These are the kinds of things, you know, a lot of stuff we've already talked about that I am passionate about. And I don't always know where the guidance comes from within me. I do a lot of research. I've taken a lot of classes. You know, I have a college degree, but I feel like there are a lot of things I have to share with the world, and I want to be that advocate for you to do whatever it is you truly want to do, and to remind you that you are worthy and you are enough and you are deserving of whatever it is you can desire. And whether people think that's hokey or not, I've seen the power of what can happen when someone has a cheerleader, an advocate, a voice in their ear saying, yeah, dude, you deserve that. Try it out. You're worth it. I am absolutely a positive person. I am an idealist, but I've seen in my own life how it really can transform when we have that support. So Sunlight School is built around that premise. So in addition to having new content roll out every single month, I'm looking to my audience to dictate what they need so that it is this interactive experience. So it's really the next best thing to working with me one-on-one. Even in a 10-minute video I've recorded, I've had people say, this changed my life, right? Like, you've experienced, you hear that one sentence and it clicks for you in a way that you had never heard before. And ultimately, that's what I'm doing, is I'm offering a perspective to activate within you that light of truth that you know, so you can be your own best guide moving forward.
Yeah.
Really providing you with as many resources as possible in a way that works for you so that you can be the one to transform your life.
That's awesome.
So that's what I do right now. And then on top of that, I mean, we've got public speaking, and I'm really inspired by your podcast. It's something I've always wanted to do. And I also create beautiful printed products. So I'm a planner calendar geek. So I'm working on a line of planners and journals and, you know, printed publications that you'd find in a bookstore that also are a tool for helping you love yourself and the life that you create, because that's what I'm all about.
Yeah. 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 Definitely. Cool. Yeah, this is awesome. So I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you, okay. Eddie. I'm really, really happy for you doing this, and I can't wait to hear the rest of your podcast. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. Bye.
All right. Bye.